And he looked at me and he grabbed me by the jersey and he said, with so many expletives that I can't put on here, but that's how you play the game. Don't you ever change.
Wow.
He said, that some bitch will learn how to slide next time, and every damn one of those guys in that dugout sees that you're willing to do that, and they will slide next time earlier.
Thanks for checking out this podcast presented by Minnesota's very own Ticket King. If you're looking for tickets for an upcoming game or event at TCF Bank Stadium, US Bank Stadium, or XL Energy Center, visit TicketKingOnline.com or the link from the 1500ESPN.com sports calendar page. Ticket King has all your tickets for Minnesota football, plus all the concerts, all the theaters, and at all venues. Call 612-341-4141 or visit TicketKingOnline.com.
Career narratives, off-the-field anecdotes, more in-depth discussions that pull back the curtain on the game. This is a show that explores the soul of baseball.
The Twins are going to win the World Series. He is safe. Safe on the play. She is gone.
Welcome to the Hardball Society Podcast with Bill Metke and Justin Musial.
Welcome to the Hardball Society Podcast. I'm Phil Mackey, former Major League beat writer, current talk show host on ESPN Twin Cities. Justin Musial, he's a pro scout, founder of Elite Sports Advising, and we're just a couple of baseball junkies who come from two different perspectives. And on each episode, we like to pull back the curtain in search of stories, opinions, baseball culture. On this episode, we sat down with the recently retired Willie Bloomquist. Actually, when we sat down with him, he was working out at Arizona State University.
Yeah.
And sort of lamenting the fact that, like, how can nobody want a veteran
right,
like me
right.
in camp somewhere?
Yeah.
And we got talking a little bit about just how teams are just structured differently now. There's an analytics wave. And Willie, and he'll talk about this in the interview here coming up, though. But Willie was very much adamant that we can't lose touch of the human element of baseball. And some of that gets lost in the last 10 years or so with the Fangraphs and baseball prospectus. But I understand why he has beef with some of these analytical perspectives. Because if I'm not mistaken, Fangraphs.com actually coined Willie as the definition of a replaceable player.
You know, and he's in a situation where we can kind of talk about some of the intangibles that can't be quantified, right? And I think Willie's in that situation where, I mean, he has a lot of really good experience. And some of those things we'll get into, but... Yeah, I mean, for him, analytics is definitely not a good thing.
So let's do this, because I've been curious. I know you're not a grizzled veteran, old, crusty scout. You're in your 30s.
Not at all. Early 30s, too, by the way.
So you're definitely more – you're bridging the gap is what you're doing.
Yep.
You've got a scouting background, and that's what you get paid to do, but you're also – you know, you were born in the 80s. So it's like
right,
you grew
right.
up. Let's – and I come from more – I used to create my own projection spreadsheets, and I've been all in on analytics for a long time on more of the media side. I'm going to give you two things that annoy me about the scouting side, two things I wish the scouting side understood more about the analytics side, and you do the same thing on the other side.
Deal.
So you represent scouts, and you tell me two things you wish the analytics people would understand more about maybe the human element or scouting.
I love it, man. To qualify it, though, I'm not necessarily all the way on the traditional side. So I think there's a good mix, but I'll take my side, the traditional side, for this sake.
So if this was politics, you're not like fully Republican, like you're kind of, you're just more in the middle, but you're going to represent Donald Trump right now.
yeah. So I'm going to go on. I'll go on the traditional scouting side. I do definitely slant more of that side just because that's what I do. But I think, and we can discuss it more, but I think I might even agree with some of your points. I just want to make that clear.
Okay, so everyone's going to be all in on analytics and all the scouts are going to be working. All right, let me start with this one. And this one drives me nuts. There's a guy pitching in the major leagues right now that has benefited from this for at least 4 or 5 years. It drives me nuts when scouts try to out-scout a track record. If a track record exists, and this is more major leaguers. You're not really going to – this doesn't really exist with developmental guys.
Yes.
They haven't built track records.
Right.
But I'll give you an example of a guy in the major leagues right now. I don't mean to pick on him, but Mike Pelfrey still makes like $8 or $9 million a year. And whether it was the Twins a few years ago or the Tigers this time around, scouts look at him and they see 93 movement, big tall frame, right? All like he's a horse frame. He's a good clubhouse guy. All these classic scouting boxes that you would check off.
Yep.
but he's been in the major leagues for 10 years and has a 4.5 ERA, mostly in the National League. And all of his advanced numbers, fielding independent pitching and XFIP and everything you could sort of line it up against and try and validate or poke holes in it, he is who he is after a certain amount of years. And so often you see, I don't know if it's that scouts sometimes want to believe that there's, hey, if we just get him in our system, we could work with him. He's got the
talent.
Sure. But when scouts try to out-scout a track record, it drives me crazy.
I think that's a very fair point. So that was a good example because the one thing I would say about that, kind of throwing it back on the traditional side, you see some things from a scouting perspective that you want, you know, that you think you maybe can change or your system, you maybe believe in your development more than other organizations. The one thing I would say is Pelfrey does not miss bats. That's as simple as it gets. I mean, he can, I don't care if a guy throws 98 with a big hook, like big hammer, you know, good changeup, good secondary stuff. If he's not missing bats, there's nothing else I need to see, right? And yeah, maybe there are some adjustments he can make, but if his stuff is not getting guys out,
yeah,
I don't get it either. So I'm with you on that.
Okay. And the second thing I'll bring to you too is, this is sort of a wide umbrella that could have a million things underneath it. It's when the traditional baseball people, whether it's scouts or just the anti-analytics crowd, has a lack of understanding of what's sustainable and what isn't. When a team has an overall batting average of, let's say, 260, but their batting average with runners in scoring position collectively for that individual year is 300, and there's a 40-point gap between it. And so they naturally score more runs because they're hitting in clutch situations at a higher level and a higher clip. And a non-analytics person might look at that and say, oh, they're just more clutch. But that's not necessarily sustainable.
Right.
So, and another example might be a pitcher who has a 2.5 ERA for the first half of the season, but you look at the advanced metrics and the fielding independent pitching or the XFIP, whatever it may be, is a run and a half or two runs higher. And maybe that pitcher is the process by which he's performing at is a 4.5 ERA, according to FIP and XFIP, but the result has been a 2.5 ERA. And the narrative might be, well, this pitcher's turned a corner.
Yeah.
Maybe turned a corner, but you should probably treat him like a 4.5 ERA guy and straighten right. out the walk rate's too high. Or, you know, his batting average on balls in play against is far too low. Maybe he's giving up a 240 batting average on balls in play, but it really should be 300 or something. So
yeah.
when people don't understand the sustainability of certain trends in baseball, it drives me crazy. And then like you've seen teams in the past, the Seattle Mariners in like 2006 or 7, I think they won maybe 86 or 88 games, and they finished behind either Texas or the Angels. I can't remember who was winning that division that year. And they looked at that team in the offseason, and they said, okay, let's make a big trade here. We're going to trade Adam Jones and George Sherrill, and we're going to make a play. We're going to get Eric Bedard in here. I can't remember who else they landed in that trade, but they traded to the Orioles, and they landed Eric Bedard and a couple other guys. And they failed to realize, having been outscored by 30 runs that previous season, that their 88 wins, they weren't really an 88-win team. They were like an 80-win team that got sort of lucky and was just a little more clutch in certain situations. And instead of treating the team in the offseason like an 80-win team, how do we get 10 more wins? They thought, oh, we just need two more wins to get to 90, and we're a playoff team. They didn't understand fundamentally the sustainability of their performance. Make sense?
I love it, man. I think those are really good points.
I'm not saying fire everyone. I'm just...
No, I think it's a really valid point. I mean, there are some things, you know, clutch, right? Like that term clutch that we use all the time, going back to that, I mean, part of your point was... You know, there might be a certain momentum that a player gets in a season where they feel really confident. I think there's a psychological aspect of that, psychological piece. And I think that can be a little bit contagious in a lineup, but very unpredictable that it's going to follow over into the next season, right?
Yeah. I mean, clutch does exist and momentum does exist, but to predict clutch and to predict momentum, it's super fleeting, right?
For sure. Yep. I'm totally with you. So those are your two main
points.
Those are
my two. There's probably more, but those are.
I think those are good points, man.
Right.
Like I don't completely disagree with them. My first one on my side, on the traditional side, would be that analytics undermines great scouts in their experience. And I think when we take away experience in any profession, when people have a lot of experience doing something, I think that they have value in what their information is and in their ideas and what they present, right? And we can take that from profession to profession. But in baseball, I think it's really, really difficult to take analytics and if there's a scout that really likes a player but it doesn't really fit into the organization and kind of what they're looking for from an analytics standpoint, to me, I'd look at both of them, but I'd always lean towards the scout because to me, I think that's really valuable.
Yeah. I mean, the answer lies in the middle somewhere, right?
Yes.
You should never be basing all your decisions off of a spreadsheet or off of statistics, but nor should you ever just be basing everything off the eye test.
I agree. I agree.
In baseball, you know, if you compare baseball to the NFL, the best teams in baseball, because there's 160 games in 162 games, so call it 160 just for the math purposes. There's 10 times as many games in baseball as there are in the NFL. And the best teams in baseball, if you equate their record to NFL records, are 10-6, 9-7. And it takes 6 months to find. Imagine if in the NFL it took 160 games to find out like who the 9-7 caliber teams were.
Yeah.
So it tells you that it's a very – the advantages from – the good teams to the bad teams, it takes 6 months to play out. They're very fine examples, and they're hard to track with just the eyes. And this is the ultimate, you know, if you're trying to say, well, you don't need a spreadsheet to analyze today's game. You can rely on, I can tell talent with my eyes. If you and I watched, let's say, so you're a trained scout and I'm not.
Yep.
And I'm not ripping you. I'm just saying, like, if you and I
were totally ripping me.
Find a new job. If you and I were to watch the same player over the course of 6 months and just we weren't keeping track of any statistics, we were just watching the games and you had no access to box scores or any cumulative stats, would you be able after 6 months to tell me what that guy's batting average was?
Yeah, I mean, in some capacity I'd give you a good idea.
Like, but if it was 250 versus 270 or 250 versus 300,
probably not.
It might be a hit a week or something.
But I think in your lackluster comparison there, when you are with me and you're with Pro Scouts, the actual data that you're compiling is a little bit more significant than just watching a player for, you know, nine innings. I mean, you are graphing. To me, most of the time you're taking care of every at bat. Almost even pitch by pitch sometimes. Was that a fastball? Was it a breaking ball? Yeah, it's not. Sometimes to compile all that, it's not in like the formulas from an analytics side, but you are trying to figure out what are they doing against what pitch, what count was it, and you try to track that a little bit. So there is a little bit on the traditional side that, you know, we try to utilize, right, from the analytics side, but it's not in an organized fashion, and I think it needs to be cleaned up. That's why I'm in the middle on this.
Sure. All right, what's your last your annoyance?
So I think the second piece is I think that there are things that cannot be quantified. And for me, if I'm watching a game, I think that there are players in Major League Baseball. I've been to Major League Baseball games this year where I've watched players that look disinterested, that lacked hustle. I felt like there was a specific game that I watched where I don't want to necessarily call it the player, but...
Come on. Throw some people under the...
I felt like Miguel Sano in a game that I watched this year was not giving 100% effort. And I think that that's a major issue. He misplayed a ball in right field. It got over his head, and he jogged to the ball and threw it in lightly.
By the way, the Twins are on the record publicly saying some of the same things.
Oh, right, so right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so
don't feel bad.
Yeah, all right. Sorry, Miguel. He's not like my best friend, so I can say that. But, I mean, those are the things that I think you could, like, for me, I can assess that. He misplayed that ball. It doesn't go down as an error, right? So it's not quantified. He jogs after it, which I think is a major issue, not quantified. He throws it in lightly, not quantified.
Yeah.
And then after the inning, he jogs in, and it looked like he didn't care what just happened.
Yeah. I mean, and now, despite all of those things, he still has, like, 34 homers and 100 ribs in his first 160 career games. But I think the conversation with a guy like that wouldn't be necessarily, do these deficiencies prevent you from being a major leaguer, which clearly they don't.
No.
The question
no.
would be, do these deficiencies prevent you from being one of the top five players in the league?
Exactly.
If your talent is destined to potentially be top five player in the league, are there other things that you could be doing that aren't really quantifiable statistically or analytically that you might need someone to come in and put an eye test on?
Yeah. I mean, sure. I think it's valid in a sense of like, he's obviously a great player, right? Let's say there's another organization that's apart from the Twins that's looking to make a trade with them for Sano, and you're just looking at the analytics piece, right? And you're not seeing some of that. Let's just say you wipe out the scouting altogether, the traditional scouting. You're not going to see a lot of that. And to me, if I'm running that organization, I don't want that, right? I mean, yeah, there's some give and take there, right? I mean, he's still a great player. Depends on what I'm having to give up. The risk there, can you get him into a different environment to get a little bit more energy out of him? Yeah. Who knows? But I think it's valuable. And I'm going to actually go to I think this is actually a great quote. It's from an article. Nick Cafardo, your boy from the Boston Globe that you really like.
Yeah, he's a great guy to follow during the winter meetings. He always has like great scoopage during the winter meetings.
Yeah, so I found this. So the scout's job is not only to evaluate talent, but to recognize heart, desire, makeup, toughness, resiliency, adaptation to the team, culture, and the city. All the things that can't be quantified, but may be the most important traits of all.
Yeah.
And I think to me, like, that sums up my argument. So I think sometimes it's hard to compare, but our whole point of this discussion is that there's pretty good points on both sides, right? That's why both you and I fall in the middle. I'm maybe a little bit more traditional. You're a little bit more on the analytical side.
And we're super successful.
So we know. Right. Like, I think every organization should listen.
I think people are going to really enjoy this conversation with Willie Bloomquist. This was recorded before he officially retired, and he since has hung it up. And I think he sent out a message. He actually was in a batting cage and sent out, like, his final swing on social media a few weeks ago. But
can we talk about how for this podcast I was laying on my deathbed in Arizona while you got to go enjoy the 80-degree day?
Yeah, man, you were supposed to come with and hang out with us. And you tapped out at the last minute.
Goodness.
Yeah, you could have.
A little food poisoning doesn't kill you. It just makes you stronger.
Yeah, I don't know. I think Michael Jordan would have toughed it out.
Yeah, he definitely would.
Hi. I'm Quino from the Crafty Rogues podcast. My partner, John Cosgrove, is about to tell you what we do.
I am? Really? Every week we're on a microphone talking. Isn't that what we do?
What do we talk about?
We talk a wee bit about football. We try to pronounce East European countries and people with weird names like Pepe Guardiola.
Here is not our conversation, my conversation.
Your conversation.
With the gritty Willie Bloomquist. If you want show notes and other good stuff, our website is hardballsociety.com. Hardballsociety.com.
Did you see that thing about the Wisconsin bad? They're not allowed to chant airball anymore because it's... Are you kidding me?
They can't even chant... I don't think they can chant USA... Because USA sometimes stands for you suck ass. And so if you chant USA at a Wisconsin high school basketball game, it has to be for the country. And if they, I don't know how they do, they kick out 100 kids? I don't know how that works, but.
See, like when I was in high school, they had the, I quit basketball to my sophomore year. I realized there wasn't a whole lot of room for a 5'11 white guy that couldn't jump in that game. And I just figured, hey, this sport's, there's way better athletes in this sport than I'm capable of doing. So I'd focus more on baseball and football. But we'd go to the basketball games, and we had a pretty good, we'd get after it pretty good. And, we were pretty good at ragging the other team and having a good time. And after one of the games, our principal said, called us in the office the next day at school and said, hey, you guys are the ringleaders. You guys got to settle this down. It's getting borderline. So the next game we were twice as bad.
Yeah,
I mean really? We're bad? Great. We're going to make it more fun. And he just kind of looked at us and shook his head like, you guys are nuts, man. But that's how it was back then. Now everyone's so dang sensitive. You can't say anything, can't do anything. You have to be, politically correct. I don't know. Baseball locker rooms, there's no politically correct things. Everyone's equal. We love everybody, and we're going to point out flaws and weaknesses because it needs to be exposed and it needs to be out there. You need to have thick skin to to play in front of 30,000 people who are booing you, you know, or yelling at you every night. So anyway, if you don't have thick skin, this isn't really the game for you.
I want to ask you way more about clubhouse stuff and chemistry, but you mentioned your high school basketball or brief career, I guess. I want to hear about you won a state championship, right, as a quarterback when you played in high school.
Yep.
I want to hear about your high school football career. Were you a pretty good were you recruited as a quarterback, or were you just kind of scrappy 5'11" quarterback?
More of the scrappy 5'11". And we were a run first team, play action pass, kind of, you know, 3-step drop, occasional 5-step drop. You know, I mean, we won and we were good, and you know, but I think we went to a 7-on-7 camp after my junior year, prior to my senior year, and I was throwing the heck out. I was throwing really well and hitting receivers and had some pretty good arm strength. And I started kind of getting some letters from, you know, Big Sky schools, you know, Idaho, Central Washington, you know, some schools like that, Eastern Washington, and some interest. And there was, after our testing, our 40 times and vertical and stuff like that, I started getting, you know, Oregon State when they were not a real good football program before they started getting better. You know, I got Washington State and Oregon State kind of had some mild interest, and so my football coach kind of sat me down and got my take on it, and I told him, no, I'm not going to go. I'm not going to play college and college football. And at the time, I knew where my career was going to be in baseball, and he's like, okay, well, you want me to tell these guys? And I said, look, I'm flattered. A big part of me would love to play college football, but again, my body isn't such that I think I would last too long in a and I'm going to probably get a scholarship in baseball, and that's probably where I'm going to make my money down the road. So,
So when you walk on to going back, you know, maybe it's been different over the last 20 years or so since high school, but when you walk onto a baseball diamond, what do you like the most about baseball? When you come to a ballpark every day, what's the thing that you look most forward to?
You know, I think it shifted. You know, early on, I just was so excited to see all the new ballparks and take batting practice in these places and get a chance to play in, you know, the stadiums that I grew up watching. You know, the old Yankee Stadium, Boston, Fenway, you know, Wrigley Field. The aura of playing in those places, I, you know, was so excited to do that. I think as I got a little bit older, I don't want to say I started smelling the roses a little bit more, but I kind of enjoyed the interaction with some of the fans, you know, just especially the kids, you know, and kind of finally taking a deep breath saying, you know what, I was in that kid's shoes not too long ago and remembered how special it was coming to the yard, and if I even had a player look at me or, you know, whatever, how cool I thought it was, just to, you know, get an autograph or something. So I think I took that to another level as far as me kind of getting an enjoyment out of just seeing how kids would react when I would talk to them and signing a ball or talking to them. Hey, you know, how old are you? Where are you from? Just kind of being a little bit more social with some of the kids out there, I think was kind of what I looked forward to, is kind of getting the reaction from those kids after a while.
Yeah. I mean, there's not really that many guys, if you just look around, who play after they're 35 years old to begin with. So
right.
What are, if you were creating a manual for guys who are 33, 34 and looking ahead the next 5 years, like, what are some of the keys to being able to still play big league baseball past the age of 35? Do you have like little keys or tricks or things that you've changed over the years that you've had to implement?
Well, unfortunately, the way it's going right now, I don't know if you've looked this off season, there's over 70 guys who are in the big leagues that haven't signed or still free agents. So for those guys that are 35 that are aspiring to play longer than that, you better be damn good, because the way the game is shifting and the way that they seem to be being real sneaky with not signing any of us older veteran guys back, it's noticed. We've taken notice. The players have obviously noticed. And, you know, it used to be when I first came in, I mean, there were guys hanging around that were in their 40s. And if you wanted to come to spring training and chance to compete for a job, it was no problem.
You'd at least get a chance.
You'd get a call. Yeah, come to spring and shed some knowledge on the young guys or something. Mm-hmm. You know, Pat Borders, Joe Oliver, you know, John Mabry, Greg Colburn, these guys were the guys that I learned from, you know, as a rookie coming in. Those are the guys I'm like, this is how you play the game the right way. And they would put their arm around you and say, you screwed up here, fix this, don't do this, do that. And they taught you, this is why Lou Piniella hates when you do stuff like this, or this is why this is the right way to play the game. He doesn't care if you line out because your attempt was to move the runner over. That's good. You know, you're trying to do it. And they taught me the game that way. Now it's, I mean, I'm sitting here at home and I haven't even gotten a phone call. Along with 70 other guys that were, you know, 35 and over, or later veteran guys that are, they're solid players that don't have a job. There's something wrong with that. So the manual on that, I don't really have all the answers, but you know, even now to the point where if you play the game right, I don't know if that's looked at the same way it used to be. Where if you're going up there and your sole purpose is to move a runner to third base or get down a sacrifice bunt, a lot of teams don't even like when you sacrifice bunt anymore because the sabermetric says that you're not supposed to do that. Well, that's the game I grew up playing. That's the game you move the runner to third base and you get him in, drive him in with a sac fly or whatever. The game's changed that way. Obviously, there's an argument for both sides. Some say for the good. I say for the worse. I think the fundamentals of baseball are going downhill at a rapid pace. I mean, guys don't know how to bunt anymore. Guys don't know how to handle the bat and move a runner over from second to third. And sabermetrics say, oh, you made an out. Well, I say you did a baseball thing by helping your team win by moving the guy to third base.
See, I think you're onto something. Because there, first of all, there has to be a balance. There's information out there, and so information should be used properly. But
sure.
I'll give you an example just off the top of my head. The Oakland A's, obviously famous for Moneyball and all that stuff in the early 2000s, but I can't remember if it was 03, 02, one of those years where they had the big three starting staff. They had a loaded roster.
Yeah, I had to face those big three. Yeah, man, they were not fun.
I mean, those guys they had a great team. They refused to steal bases and they refused to bunt.
Right.
And so, now they've backed off that over the last 10 years and they'll pick out certain guys. Okay, this guy's good enough at stealing bases, he's not going to kill us on the base pass. But I remember they're facing the Red Sox in the playoffs, and it might have been a decisive game, ALDS. Eighth inning, and they're down by a run. Might have even been ninth inning, and they get the leadoff man on first base. And you're thinking, well, okay, no longer are you trying to play for the most runs over the course of a season, so don't waste outs. You need one run in this inning, or your season's over. And they didn't bunt, and their season ended.
And they got butchered in the media by it.
Yeah, which, I mean, the media might not even know, but still, like, it's, you can't think of it in terms of how many runs can we score over the course of 6 months when you have a game that's in the eighth inning and you're down by a run and bunting might actually increase your chances to tie the game in that particular spot. You know, it's, so you're, I think you're right.
I think if you play a winning style of baseball on a daily basis over the long haul, you're going to win more games than you lose. You know, and granted, there's arguments for not bunting. I get it. I mean, there's if you're facing a dominant closer like Mariano Rivera or somebody like that, to where if you get the leadoff guy on, you bunt him, the chances of getting a damn hit off the guy aren't very good. So it's going to take, you know, a hit to score that guy anyway. So there are arguments to where you don't bunt, but I think generally as a whole, you just play the game the right way, the way it was designed to be played, I think you're going to win more than you lose. Yeah.
What do you think for, let's say, players who are good high school players or even up through the minor leagues, so, you know, 17, 18 to 25, impressionable, talented young players, what are two or three things that you think are really, really important besides talent for those guys to eventually have long big league careers?
Well, I mean, for me, I when I got into pro ball, and I've been very, very blessed with good coaches growing up, starting with my dad, then my high school coach, and then I came to here and played with the legend Pat Murphy, you know, and then into pro ball where I had some very good coaches as well. And then, you know, obviously my big league spring trainings, as I mentioned before, the guys I learned from playing under Lou Piniella, it's like, you played the game right or you didn't play. You were sent out or gone. And for me, if you just do the game, play the game the right way, no excuses. Nobody likes to hear excuses. You go out and you just play the right way and respect the uniform and understand that the game was here a lot longer, well before you were here, and it's going to be here a lot longer after you're gone. So don't flatter yourself and think that your name on the back of your jersey matters, because at the end of the day, it doesn't. You know, the game's going to go on with or without you. But what you do is you take that uniform and respect the heck out of it and play the right way.
Yeah.
Because the game doesn't know any names in the back. And at some point, it's going to humble you. And you know, if you go out and do it the right way and play the right way and do the things the right way, you got nothing to regret at the end of it.
What's your best Lou Piniella story? You probably have a million Lou Piniella stories.
Yeah, I mean, my favorite was kind of alluding to what I just said. You know, we were in spring training, and I had heard all the stories. My first spring training, first camp, and I was in big league camp, and, you know, an abbreviated version of this story, but, you know, I was told you do things the right way and don't make excuses if you screw up. Just tell him the truth and he'll yell at you and he'll pat you on the back and that'll be the end.
Does he tell you that too? Or do you
No,
just
this
you
is the
that?
Young guys. I mean, Lou had the nostalgia of Lou Piniella. I mean, you knew what he was about and you knew right where you stood, good, bad, and different. You knew how you stood with Lou. There was no pulling any punches. You knew if he didn't like you, he'd just flat out tell you, you know, you need to change stuff or you're going to be gone. And it was, you know, he called a spade a spade. It was pretty much what you see is what you get. So I was told that, you know, just play the game the right way, and if you screw up, accept his criticism. It's nothing personal, but move on. So I was taught on turn and double play to, if a guy hasn't slid yet, to drop down and drill him because he's trying to take out your knees and, you know, quite possibly not meaning to end your career, but he's trying to take out your legs, which could end your career. So you've dropped down and put it in his mouth, and he'll slide, I promise. And if he doesn't, shame on him. That's your only defense as a middle infielder, is to make him slide earlier by dropping down. And so we were late in spring training, and there was a veteran guy that came in to take me out at second base, and I turned a double play, and I was taught to drop down and put it in his mouth, make him slide. So I did, and he put his hand up, and the ball hit off his hand and ricocheted down the line. And run scored, and it was actually the go-ahead run late in the game, and I look over, and Lou's throwing his hands up and saying a few profane words over there. And I came in the dugout, and I'm like, well, this is what it is. The guys are going to – this is what they talk about. He's going to absolutely air me out in front of everybody. And this is kind of when all the veterans were still around because it was getting late in spring and they were playing later in the games. And he came over to me at the end of the inning and started MFing me. Hey, son, what happened? You know, and I said, Lou, he didn't slide. So I dropped down and I tried to hit him in the mouth. And he looked at me and he grabbed me by the jersey and he said, with so many expletives that I can't put on here, but that's how you play the game. Don't you ever change.
Wow.
He said, that some bitch will learn how to slide next time. And every damn one of those guys in that dugout sees that you're willing to do that and they will slide next time earlier. I don't care if we lose every damn game. That's how you play. And all the veteran guys looked at me and were like, heck yeah, man. That's how you do it. And from that point on, I don't know how the impact that he knows that he had in my career, but from that day on, I'm like, you do things the right way, and guys like Lou Piniella will respect how you play.
So it sounds like he almost wanted, he came up to you as if to...
Well, he was challenging me to see if I was going
to
say...
To see if you knew what you were doing.
Knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I said, I've been taught to try and hit the guy in the mouth if he doesn't slide.
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to do. And he said, son, that is how you play the game. Because that some bitch will slide next time, and I promise you, all those guys in that dugout saw it, and they aren't going to take the chance of doing that to you next time.
Again. I feel like more and more now, whether it's at second base and hard plays at second base, or for sure when it comes to batters getting hit by pitches, the league and the umpires love to step in and make sure, okay, well, if you don't even get a chance to retaliate now. There's a warning, and then if you retaliate, your guy's out of the game in the third inning. Where do you stand on, because now we're crossing into that might be considered old school mentality, eye for an eye, police itself at second base. Where do you stand on that? Should the league and the umpires be stepping in like they are, or would you rather it just go back to?
Well, I'm one for, unfortunately, the game kind of is, in my opinion, changing toward, I'm probably going to get a lot of flack for this, but a softer mentality type game to where, oh, you hit me, let's just leave it at that. No, I mean, the old school, you talk to Curt Schilling. One of your guys gets drilled especially high, he's drilling two of you guys, not just one. Because, damn it, now you're going after someone's life and career. You don't go up by the head.
He's on the record saying he hit like 80 or 90 batters in his career. He's on the record saying almost all but maybe one or two
were intentional.
And you look at it, he never walked anybody.
Right.
So.
He had pinpoint control. Yeah. God bless him for it. And I stand on that side of the fence to where I'm like, the game should police itself. You get drilled, sorry, buddy. Someone comparable talent level on the other side is probably going to get drilled, and that's how it is. And you know, for the taking guys out at second base, hey man, you don't like it? Don't pirouette around second base with a ballerina skirt on. Get your feet in the right position and drop down and drill somebody. That's how you protect yourself. You don't do it by spinning around and throwing, and then you're getting your legs taken out by someone sliding hard and then complain about it. It's just, plays at home plate. I mean, they got it now to where as a base runner, you know what you're supposed to do. Well, if he gets in the way after he catches the ball, then you can take him out. If not, you gotta slide around and tap it with your pinky in order to be safe. It's like, You know, I personally, I'm all for the old school way of playing the game hard. This is a man's game. It's not a boy's game. Yeah. If you don't like it, don't play.
What's the most gratified or the best you've ever felt playing baseball? What's the proudest you've ever felt playing baseball?
For me, it was the September call up in 2002. I didn't really play much until kind of the second half of that month, but we were still technically in the playoff chase, and I got an opportunity to wanted to put me in a situations that mattered, you know, to see what I was made of. And that last, I think I had 30 something at bats and ended up hitting .455 that month. And for me, it was just gratifying knowing that I made it, and all the doubters out there that always claim that I would never make it, I made it. And not only did I make it, but I did some things well, you know, in a key time. I didn't know I was going to go on to play as long as I did, obviously, at the time. But looking back, that was probably the most fun, not only because I had early success, you know, that month, but it just was like the whole aura of being in the big leagues and cloud nine and being in a playoff chase and playing in the middle of it was that was pretty awesome. Close second was when I was with the D-backs in 11 and we won the division. That was being a major part of that and playing short pretty much every day and leading off for that team.
That was a fun team to watch. I feel like you had a bunch of maybe I'm overstating it, but it felt like there were a bunch of Willie Bloomquists on that team.
We got a lot of guys.
You walk out of the dugout to begin the game and your jerseys are already dirty.
Yeah,
you know?
we had some grinders on that team, and we had some guys that had chips on their shoulders, and you know, guys that, you know, they picked us to finish last in the division that year, and you know, guys like Ryan Roberts, you know, stepped up. And of course, we had some talent in there too. Justin Upton, Chris Young, Ian Kennedy, you know, had a career year that year. Miguel Montero had a great year. And that was Paul Goldschmidt was kind of up, you know, just started coming up, and he and Lyle Overbay kind of were platooning time. And we made John McDonald, Aaron Hill came over, and then our bullpen was solid at the end. So, I don't know, but that was just a fun team because, I mean, I saw things happen that year that I had never imagine I would see in the major leagues. Down by six in the ninth with an out, and we would rattle off seven runs and score and win. Won a walk-off grand slam. You know, Ryan Roberts walk-off grand slam. Like, who the heck are these guys? And what are they doing? We're just playing out of our freaking fannies and winning. And it was a blast. We had a lot of fun that year, and especially with manager being Gibby and, you know, Matt Williams and Eric Young, those type of guys around. It was just that was a fun year, too.
Yeah. Okay, on the flip side, what's the most insecure baseball has ever made you feel? What's the most you've ever questioned yourself in baseball, in your baseball life?
Oh, well, last year was up there, definitely. You know, coming off, a decent year the year before, but I entered with the blowing out my knee. And then coming in last year and working as hard as I could in the offseason to get where a lot of people said I'd never play again. Not only did I get back to healthy, but I got back to actually running as fast, if not faster, than the year before, and felt great. And then, just really not playing a whole lot again and kind of reverting back to kind of the earlier days of my career where I just was kind of an afterthought of getting thrown in there maybe against a setup guy or something, and, hitting a .150 and then getting released. And I'm just like, man, what happened? I thought I kind of had this going the right direction where I was being used quite a bit and playing and being an impact and being solid, being used quite a bit to hardly being used at all and hitting a .150 and getting released and then having the phone not ring all last off season. And then now here we are this off season and I'm still a week away from spring and I haven't gotten a job. So this certainly has been humbling, I guess, for lack of a better term. And now if the phone never rings and doesn't ring, I'm okay. I'm great with the career I've had. I got no regrets. But, if it I certainly didn't want to end that way. And that's kind of probably the lowest I've been, has been, was probably after I got released and the phone didn't ring. So. Yeah.
And I know you have to go work out here in a little bit, which is a good segue to just a few random sort of quick-hitting random questions to close this thing out. You can answer as long as you want. If you're passionate about the answer, feel free. Don't let me cut you off. But I think your last answer is a good sort of segue into what would you, if you had a full year now, let's say, you know, whenever you hang it up and you're done with baseball, you have a full year to master another skill or another trait or another career, whatever it is. What would you do in that full year? And you can't say golf because everyone says golf. I feel like all the baseball guys say golf.
At my age?
Sure. Yeah, well, whenever, like, sometime in the next 5 years, whenever you, if someone gave you a full year, your schedule's clear, and you can master one thing, what would you do?
Oh, boy. You know, I'm an avid outdoorsman, love to hunt and fish. I've gotten to be a pretty good long-range shooter with my Weatherby deal that I have, so I think it would be pretty awesome to be kind of like, God rest his soul, a Chris Kyle type, where you just be able to shoot stuff from 200, 2,000 yards away and just drop a dime on something. I think it would be cool to, and I got a wife and kids at home, so this would never happen, but I think it would be cool to defend our country with being kind of a sniper.
Wow.
I think it would be awesome. Now, that being said, I would never do it now at this stage in my life with the family I have and everything, but I think it would be, that would be really cool to do something like he did. It was just awesome. I thought that story was tremendous, and I respect the heck out of him, and, you know, I thought that was really neat what he did.
Do you have military family background at all?
No, not really. I had one cousin that flew in Desert Storm, Harrier pilot, and that's the only relative I have really that was in the military. Obviously, I knew Pat Tillman pretty well when he was here, and his brother Kevin, and that was very admirable what he did, and he's a legend forever for that. And I don't know. I just think the craft of being able to shoot like he did and do the stuff that he did and defend our country in the meantime, I think is pretty cool.
If Rob Manfred, baseball commissioner, said, "All right, I'm giving you the keys. You get to change two or three things." And no checks and balances. Whatever Willie Bloomquist says, we're going to change or alter or add those two or three things to the game. What would you do?
I would get rid of instant replay. Would be my first thing.
Umpires would get shredded. Maybe they wouldn't, because if you got rid of it on TV, then they wouldn't get shredded.
They're paid to do a job, and I think the umpires that we have, for the most part, they're pretty dang good. But I think, bashing instant replay, but I'm saying when it's not right when a guy steals a bag in second base and he's sliding over the bag and his stomach comes off the base for a fraction of a second and the glove's on him and they review it for 10 minutes and then they call the guy out. I'm like, no, he beat the play. He was safe. It's kind of going a little too far.
You see more and more of those, the pop-ups.
Like the pop-up slide where the guy...
Very briefly.
Yeah, whereas...
If he overslides the bag, that's one thing.
Right.
But,
Spike comes off the top after he just hits a two-run double in the gap, and now he's out.
That is annoying, yeah.
That's kind of... It's taken it to a whole other level to where... You know, I don't mind the bang-bang plays at first getting reviewed or the scoring plays. Those are fine, but I think, of course, like anything, they take a good thing and they overdo it to make it a thing that just is like, come on, guys, this is an imperfect game. Yeah. Let's keep it that way. And these umpires are actually pretty good for the most part. So, you know, that would be one thing.
So you and I would brawl because I am pro electronic strike zone right at some point.
I think it's going to get to that point. I really do. I guess if that were one complaint I did have about the umpires, it would be the strike zone.
Because you want to know when you walk up there in the eighth inning in a one-run game. Just I want to know... You've been in the league for 15 years. Yeah. You know what the zone is. You don't want to have to be guessing on a coin flip pitch.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right. And I guess from that standpoint, it is, in key games, too, obviously, and to where it matters. Yeah, I mean, there is definitely an argument for that, and I don't – I just think parts of the replay just – it just bothers me. I think the length of the season, the schedule length, I would shorten it.
150 something, or
I would do 140. I think it would be 140. Have every Monday off. You play six at home, six on the road. come home, day off, six at home, day off, six on the road. And everyone's on the same schedule, and Monday is the off day for the whole major leagues. And I don't know. I mean, I just think it, I think the schedule, and I know that everyone's going to say, well, what about the records and all that stuff? You know, I agree. That's that part of it sucks. But I just think, you know, the star players stay healthier all year long, or have a better chance of staying healthy. You know, and I think you're playing the most important games a lot of times now in the snow, you know, or late freezing cold and rain. And I know it's always been that way, but you know, we're the boys of summer, man.
I'm a target field guy. I kind of feel you on that one. Yeah, early April and once in a while October.
I mean, just you know, it overlaps football season. I think that everyone should have their own climax of their baseball season. I think the playoffs are, you know, designed are the best teams. The design should be played in good weather. So, yeah.
If you could go back and tell 18-year-old Willie Bloomquist something that you wish you would have known then, what would you tell 18-year-old Willie?
You know, I don't have a whole lot of regrets playing-wise. I think my abilities, what I was able to get out of my abilities this far, I have no complaints over that. Obviously, sure, you can always go back and wish you would have done better. I wish I would have, you know, been a career 300 hitter, or wish I would have hit more home runs, or wish I would have done that. But at the end of the day, how I went about it, and I think what I've gotten out of my God-given ability, I think I have no regrets as far as how I played. And, you know, I mean, I'm as good as I am. I've got the best out of my talent, I think. And for me to wish I would have been better at something, I worked as hard as I could to get as good as I could, so I don't really have any regrets when it comes to that. But what to tell myself is just understand that this is a business. This game is a business. Never know when your last day is going to be. And there's part of me that wishes I would have maybe enjoyed it a little bit more, because the 13 years went over really, really fast. And a lot of times I just was so worried about getting a job the next year, or, you know, what do I got to do this year? What do I have to do? I want to start. I want to be this type of player, that I didn't really, I didn't enjoy it enough. And all of a sudden it's over. Now I'm looking back going, gosh, I wish I would have, you know, relished in that a little bit more, enjoyed it a little bit more. But, I guess at the end of the day though, like I said, I don't have many regrets.
Yeah. And then final question for you, if you had, you have an hour to get dinner with or hang out with one baseball person, dead or alive, that you've never met before. Who would you want to spend an hour with?
Baseball player?
Or baseball figure. Anyone around baseball.
Man. You have to give me a second on this one. I'm going to say... I would say Mickey Mantle. I mean, he obviously, you know, I don't know this for sure because I never knew him, obviously, but I think from what I understood, he didn't take care of himself really well off the field, but how he played on the field was, I mean, arguably probably the one of the best athletes that there ever was in the game. And who knows if he could have stayed healthy a little bit longer and obviously lived a little bit longer, it would have been a treat for everybody that knew him. But I don't know. I think he just was, the way he played was pretty awesome. I mean, he was balls to the walls, full speed the whole time.
As a star, too.
And as a superstar. Right. And I mean, he was probably the most talented guy of that era. Probably him, Mickey Mantle, maybe Babe Ruth, obviously, would be a good one, too.
Yeah. I think almost everyone said Babe Ruth so far.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, how could you not want to spend an hour drinking beer with him on a train ride or
right.
something, you know?
Big old stogie hanging out of his mouth. I think that would be pretty cool.
Yeah.
But, all those old-time Yankee guys are pretty cool, I think. Would be fun to hang out with them.
Thanks, Willie.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Stay tuned for 60-second AP News headlines. Healthcare discussions. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute.
I want everyone to know I'm 100% behind this.
President Trump met with at the White House with Republican lawmakers about the GOP health care bill. He says the press has not been speaking properly about how great this bill is.
I watch. I say that's not the bill we're passing. And I also want everyone to know that all of these no's or potential no's are all yeses, every single person sitting in this room.
On Capitol Hill, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price says they're hearing the Obama health care plan is not responding to people's needs.
They don't have the kind of access that they want. They don't have, they're not able to afford. We met this week at the White House with many individuals who felt they'd been harmed by Obamacare, by the ACA.
The president is meeting with German Chancellor Angela Merkel at the White House. The government says February recorded its second hottest temperature on record, behind only last year. I'm Ed Donahue.